Right, today I'm going to talk about the tangle hypothesis in low dimensions, which relates to the first and second columns of diagrams in the handout. Has everyone got a handout? And I'll talk about the third column a little bit tomorrow, together with the general column, as it were. So let's just remind ourselves what the tangle hypothesis is about. The tangle hypothesis says that the N category of framed N tangles in N plus K dimensions, is somehow equivalent to, perhaps N plus K equivalent to, the free K-tuply monoidal N category with duals on one object. Like all of these hypotheses that we've been talking about, none of the terms in the hypothesis have really been defined, and they're all quite difficult to understand. So we have to understand what the N category of framed N tangles in N plus K dimensions is supposed to be. We don't really understand this notion of higher equivalence, and we've got to understand the free K-tuply monoidal N category with duals. So there's a manifold side of this picture, and there's an algebra side of this picture. And what the handout it's giving you some pictures of what the manifold side of this is supposed to be like. And what we're going to do is investigate what sort of algebraic structure yields those things as its free such thing on one object, and thereby try and decide what an N category with duals is supposed to be. Because it should be an N category, and it should have duals, right? But then there are some questions about coherence and about how all the different pieces of structure should interact. And we'll see, as we get into some of the more interesting parts of these dimensions, even in the very low dimensions, we'll see that there are some interesting questions about how these different parts of the structure cohere with each other. So first of all, let's give ourselves an idea about why we're expecting something like this to be true. So what's a framed N tangle in N plus K dimensions? Framed N tangle in N plus K dimensions is more or less going to be some kind of N manifold with corners embedded in an N plus K cube, an N plus K unit cube, in such a way that all the corners get embedded in sort of cornerish type places of the cube. That is, so that all the corners get embedded in places where, if they're a codimension J corner, they should go into places where the last J coordinates inside this cube are 0 or 1, so that they appear at some kind of edge. Codimension J corner of the cube is an N manifold with corners. I haven't said anything about this frame business yet. It's an N manifold with corners embedded in the unit N plus K cube in such a way that codimension J corners are mapped to codimension J corners of the cube. So that's what it would be if it weren't framed. The framing gives us a trivialization of the normal bundle of this thing, which we were just talking about, some of us outside. What this gives us in particular is it tells us that the submanifold of this cube has an orientation, but it gives us a bit more than that. And we'll see that in the case of one manifold in, so for one manifold in two cubes, it doesn't give us anything more than that, because there's nothing much you can do. But once you're a one manifold in a three cube, it gives us something more interesting, which is what knot theorists usually call a framing on a knot. So it's sort of, you've got these vectors going around your, here's your manifold, and you've got these normal vectors, and it tells you that these, you pick a direction for them all the way around, so you can sort of twist your way around this this one manifold. And we'll see that what Shum did to understand these was consider them as not pieces of string, but thickened them to being pieces of ribbon. So the piece of ribbon can remember what kind of twist you've done to it, and that encapsulates this framing on it. So we'll see that a bit later. So it's an N manifold. Together with trivialization of the normal bundle. Which in particular gives an orientation. Sorry?
Does it make any difference if you take a particular embedding?
I think I mean a particular embedding. Yeah. So at some point, because we want to do an N category of these things, we're going to have to take some sort of equivalence classes at some point. And it's a bit subtle as to what sorts of equivalence classes you want to take. So let's have a look at, but in general, what this structure is, why this is supposed to be, why it's supposed to be a K2-plenoidal N category at all. So if it's going to be a K2-plenoidal N category, then we can also think of it as an N plus K category whose bottom K dimensions are trivial. So it should also be a K degenerate N plus K category. So it's zero cells and it's one cells, and everything all the way up to K minus one cells should be trivial. So it's K cells are the first non-trivial dimension, and its K cells are going to be zero manifolds embedded in K cubes. Framed. What I write here is more to get our dimensions straight rather than to think about the very technical definition of these manifolds. So it's K plus one cells are going to be some one manifold embedded in K plus one cubes. And so on up to K plus N. The K plus N cells are going to be our N manifolds in K plus N cubes. Probably isotopy classes of them. And we'll see a bit more about what kinds of classification this gives us later. So remember that this, when we perform our dimension shift, we decide that we're going to ignore those dimensions because they were trivial and start again from here. So these become the zero cells of our K2-plenoidal N category. So as a K2-plenoidal N category, these are going to be the zero cells, these are the one cells, and these are the N cells. So over here, these will come equipped with K kinds of composition, which came from the fact that as K cells of this N plus K category, they had K kinds of composition. And you can see now that if these are zero manifolds in K cubes, we have K different ways we can stick cubes together to compose them, which is in each of the k dimensions that we have. So, in general, m dimensional boxes can be stacked in m ways. So we get k compositions on our zero cells. So for example, if our zero cells are zero manifolds in a two cube, then we have a composition that we can do in this direction, and we have a composition that we can also do in that direction. But because these zero cells are never going to be at the actual edge of the cube, there isn't going to be any source target matching condition on the edges of these cubes, and that's why it's, although it looks like it's very cubical, there's no source and target matching condition here, so it's really just like a tensor product. Okay, so that's an indication of why it should be some sort of K2-Plumanoidal N category. So what about this business of duals? Well, with all these pictures of manifolds embedded in cubes, there's some very natural symmetry in the situation that arises, because any given manifold in a cube, we could just turn the whole thing upside down, and it would still be a perfectly good manifold in a cube that satisfied all the conditions, and we can reflect it in any of the axes that we want, and that will still be a perfectly good thing. So we see that there's this possibility of changing the direction, but we won't expect it to be an inverse for the thing that we started with. We'll expect it to be something a little bit weaker than that. And Byers and Dolan, they make an analogy to the situation where we're studying homotopy. They say that we've seen that an important algebraic structure to have around in an N category, if you're going to use it to study homotopy, is inverses. And they conjecture that an important algebraic structure to have around if you want to study TQST is duals. So what's a dual? A dual inside an N category should be like the internal notion of a junction. And if you were at Peter May's talk the other day, he was talking about duals inside bicategories a lot. And Steve Lack helpfully reminded us that they're also called a junction. So a dual is the internal notion of a junction. So adjoint functors are the one cells of the two category cat. So those can be regarded as something internal to the two category cat. And whenever we have some piece of structure on categories, we can ask if we can look for it inside any other two category other than cat. So that's what we do here. So for example, adjoint functors are dual one cells inside the two category cat. So what should a dual for a one cell look like? Well, a dual for F that goes from A to B, so let's make a right dual, should be a one cell G that goes from B to A, equipped with a unit and co-unit as usual. So those would be two cells G, that's the wrong way around, that's eta, that's G So that's the co-unit. And these satisfy the usual triangle identities. Which is that if you paste them in this direction, that's the identity. And if you paste them in the other direction, that's also the identity. Well, that's all very well if you're inside a strict two-category. But already, if we want to do this inside a weak two-category, then it's going to be a whole lot more complicated. Because you'll observe that here, inside my two-pasting diagram giving these axioms, I've got three one cells composed in a row. And in a strict two-category, we can interpret that uniquely because we have associativity on the nose. But if we're in a weak bi-category, we've already got to fiddle around a bit here because we've got to associate on this side and then we've got to insert an associator and reassociate on the other side. But it's even worse than that because secretly, I didn't say this because I didn't need to in a two-category. What we've got here is, in fact, this is supposed to be equal to the identity two-cell on F. But look, this is F composed with a unit. And if we're in a weak two-category, the unit isn't strictly unital. So we'll have to insert a unitator as well here to make it all work out. So in a strict two-category, if we write this out as a commutative diagram of two cells, what we get is F going to F, G, F going to F. But in a bi-category, we have to be much more pedantic about it and say that F has to go to F1. Okay, so this is F eta, and this is epsilon F. So we have to insert a 1 using a unit, and then we can do our F eta, because really that goes to F with GF in brackets like that. Then we have to reassociate it to get F and G bracketed together. And at this point, we can apply epsilon F to get back to, now I've run out of space, to get back to 1F. And now we have to apply a left unit to get back to F before we can even ask for it to be commutative like this. Otherwise, it makes no sense. So that's all very well in a bi-category. Now, if we try to do this inside a tri-category, then all sorts of more exciting things can happen, because really we shouldn't ask for this to be an equality, because these are two cells, and in a tri-category we shouldn't ask for equalities between two cells. This equality should in fact turn into a piece of coherence data, so this should become an isomorphism. Then we have to ask ourselves what axioms that isomorphism would have to satisfy, blah, blah, blah. So this question remains extremely open. We don't even know what it is in a tri-category, do we? No, we don't. Yeah. Yeah. So there are some things. All right. So maybe we. Well. All right. It's a question anyway. So for general N. Question. So it's just faintly possible that studying how these things behave in our manifold situation could help us understand what's supposed to happen in general for duals. So before we've even thought about what an N category with duals should be, we've got lots of questions open about what duals are in the first place. And once we've even answered that question, there are all sorts of other questions about how those pieces of coherence data should interact with the pieces of coherence data in the N category that we started with. That's a question that remains open. But before we think about that, let's think about why, in our manifold situation, we expect there to be these duals at all. Okay, so for manifolds, so for example, let's think about morphism, the one cell being one manifold in a 2-square. Okay. So we could have something like this. Let's call that X, and let's call that X oriented in the opposite way. We could have a thing like this. So this is X tensor X star going to the empty thing down here. So in order to get something going from the empty thing to X tensor X star, because we just, for a start, we need something going in the opposite direction. Well, sorry, I haven't erased very well. We can just reflect the entire thing and then reverse the orientation of the one cell. So we reflect it in a direction that we're thinking about. And then to make this orient in the right direction, we just reverse its orientation. So then what would we get for unit and co-unit? For the co-unit, what we want to do is we want to take, so let's call this one, I think it's going to be better if I call that one F and this one G. So we want to compose them, first of all, because we want something that goes from F composed with G. That's the wrong way around. F composed with G to the unit on X tensor thingamajig. So here's the box for this side, and here's the box for that side, and it's going to turn into a big box like this. It's not a very good box. Okay, now there seem to be some colors here, so I might as well use them. Right. So here's our G, which goes from this thing to this thing, and here's our F, which goes from nothing to that thing. Okay, and so it's got to all go end up going down to the identity on that. Well, the identity is just going to look like this, nothing happens. And what we can do is we can take this manifold and we can rotate it like this round to its dual and sort of sweep out a 2-manifold as we go along, keeping the edges fixed. So the edges stay fixed like this. And then we sweep out a 2-manifold like this. And so the unit, so that's the co-unit, because it's gone to the identity on X tensor X star. So for the co-unit, we want to do it the other way around. It's going to be something from the empty manifold, the empty subset, back to there. So this is now F and that's G. So here's our, whoops, that's terrible. So F is like this, and G is like that, and the identity is just nothing down there. There's nothing down there. And again, we just rotate this manifold around and sweep out a surface. So this looks like that. And then we can try sticking them together to make triangle identities. I'm going to decline to do that on the blackboard. Okay, are there any questions about why we're expecting this to to be, yeah. Why? But it's more than that, isn't it? I thought there was some sort of physics reason that we didn't want. I mean, these. Right. Well, I think this is heading towards studying TQST, right? And when we're studying TQST, Aaron should probably say more about this than me. But we want our things to be oriented because we're thinking about space time, and we want that to be oriented. Why do we want an entire framing rather than just an orientation on our manifold? Is there a good answer to that? So we'll see when we start looking at the braided monoidal category with Joule's case, we'll see that we're sort of forced to get a framing if we want to get a sensible coherence out of it. So there's a kind of algebraic motivation. So when Shum first proved that, she wasn't thinking about TQST, she was thinking about trying to generalize a coherence result, and in order to make it sensible, it was necessary to get a framing. So that might help answer the question. Are there any more questions? Okay. Yeah. 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 You can ignore the fact that I mean this is an object. So if we're doing the place where objects are zero cells in one cubes and morphisms are one cells in two cubes. So the object here is, I'm just telling you, it's a pair of points up there, which I haven't really said anything about the monoidal structure, but that happens to, I just wrote it as X tensor X star. I'm just defining what this morphism G is, and I'm giving a name to its source and its target so that we can see which way up we want it to be in its dual. So whatever is along this bottom of the square is the target of this morphism, because the target is the zero manifold in the one square, which is this interval here, which is supposed to be the boundary of this manifold. It just happens that it's empty at this end. Yeah? And so the source of it is the zero manifolds along the top, which is the boundary of it. The top, yeah?
So she's trying to get to what it means for these two morphisms, for these two G and S to be adjoint to each other. So for these things to be adjoint, you should have a unit and co-unit satisfying the triangle identities. So that picture on the left is, I don't know.
It's the co-unit.
Maybe draw like a big arrow from the source to the target.
I did. A bigger one. S. Yeah.
And then you could draw like a little unit going between there, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So this is like... Like this, you mean?
Yeah. And then this is your unit here, which is co-unit.
That's a co-unit.
And then over right there, I guess, you're
talking. Oh, I did it the wrong way up. Is that what's confusing you?
Well, what's confusing me is that you're defining S1 means S to be the dual of G as one morphism.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you've also got the dual of zero morphisms in X and X star.
Yeah, maybe that was just an unnecessary piece of thing that confused you.
So
you can
all of them.
Yeah.
So... I suppose I haven't, but I mean, I only wrote that to be the same point with its orientation reversed, because everything is supposed to be oriented, so even the points have to have an orientation, which you can write as a plus or a minus or a thing or a not star. If you want, yes, you can say that X is dual to X star, and this is its co-unit, and this is its unit. And then the triangle identity says... But if you want to do that, there is a manifold. So there is a manifold which does this. So that would be your unit eta. If you didn't want to be an actual axiom, you could put in a two cell that looked like that to show that these are the unit and co-unit validly. I'll come back to that a bit later. Is that? Sorry?
Yeah,
Right, but this is the dual. So this is the dual of that. Right. So this is actually a very subtle point, which I will talk about later. But the fact that these can be this way around or that way around. So as a unit and co-unit, they're opposite ways around. But as this dual just to this morphism, it's this way around because we just wanted to reflect it. Because, look, this target has to be exactly the same as this source, which means it has to be the same way around. Okay. I mean, that is a very subtle point that we'll come back to. Did that help, Bruce? Okay. So there are some slightly peculiar dimensional things to think about here. One is that if we are the N cells in an N category, then we haven't got any more dimensions left with which to talk about unit and co-unit. So, for N cells in an N category, we have no dimensions left in which you have units and co-units, because they're supposed to be the dimension up from the cells that we're talking about. But in our manifold structure, we still can do this reflection thing. So there still is something to be said that seems somehow relevant, and it seemed relevant enough to Byers and Dolan that they decided that an N category with duals should have this piece of structure at the top dimension, even though there wasn't going to be any unit and co-unit. So category theorists sometimes think this is a bit odd, because all you're saying is, oh, there exists a morphism going in the opposite direction. But let's just leave that for a second. So a dual for an N cell from A to B is simply an N cell B to A. And the other thing is that generally for zero cells in a category, you also can't have a unit and co-unit, because you haven't got any way of saying what the source and target of that unit and co-unit would be, because you need some kind of composition or tensor product. So it might seem that we shouldn't say anything unless we're in some kind of monoidal N category. Now, in most of our cases, we will be in some kind of monoidal category, because if we had, it's only not going to be some kind of monoidal category if we have no co-dimension here, in which case we're talking about zero manifolds in zero space and one manifold in one space, which isn't terribly interesting. But Byers and Dolan do it anyway, because we haven't got very many examples to go on, so we have to use anything we can get our hands on, I suppose. So zero cells we can only have unit and co-unit if we have some monoidal structure. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. With some... Well, maybe I should say it just has no unit and co-unit. Has no unit and co-unit. So one of the things that's interesting about this, some more algebraically minded people object to that notion of having N cells at the top that don't really do it, the duals at the top that don't really have anything governing their structure apart from some interaction with composition. But something a bit interesting happens in the braided monoidal case, because you can define it without having those things at the top and still somehow get the same thing. So that's an interesting question, which we'll see later. Yeah.
We want to have the fact that this cup had an opposite cup. You know, this is like saying it has a cell going the other way.
Yeah.
But once we go to a one dimension higher, the fact that you wanted to have a unit and co-unit will become actual surfaces.
Right. So the interaction with it. So when you take these isotopy classes, and then tomorrow you decide that you're going to take them one level up, you wanted to know that those things were there. And when we think about the omega category of these things, then that's going to be an interesting question as well. Okay. Yeah. Well, they don't object, but they just think it's a bit strange and that there should be a better way of saying it. Which maybe there is, as we'll see from the Brady-Monoidal category case. Okay. So let's perhaps just quickly remind ourselves of some of the issues that we're going to look for. Because we don't really know what an N category with duals is supposed to be, there are some issues about the interaction of duals of different dimensions of So we've already seen, as Doretta pointed out, that there's something going on here between the unit and co-unit for the zero duals together with the dual of something at the next level up. So that's a question. There's a question about double duals and how they should be related to the thing that we started with. There's a question that Bruce mentioned about duals and composition. What happens if you take the dual of a composite and the relationship between that and the composite of the dual? And there's a question about duals and the coherent cells for the N category in the first place. And of course, these coherent cells are likely to be isomorphisms or perhaps adjoint equivalences inside our N category. And if they're adjoint equivalences, they're some kind of dual. So those duals, there's a question about those duals and these duals and whether they should be the same. And thus, duals. Okay, so these are all features to look out for when we start examining our low dimensional cases. Here would be an injudicious place to start, I think. Start over here. So what I'm going to do is sort of have the manifold stuff on this side and the corresponding algebraic stuff on this side. And we're going to start with some rather odd degenerate-looking cases, which are going to be the first column of this handout, where we've got examples of n equals 0, and then k, the codimension, gradually increasing. So we're going to have, on this side, the manifolds, and on this side, the algebra. So over here, it should be some sort of K2-plumonoidal N-category with some extra structure, which we're going to look for by looking at the behavior of the manifolds over here. So, and the manifolds should be the free one of those on one object. So it's kind of a question of coherence, because coherence is often a question about what the free thing on one thing is. And we'll see when we do the Brady-Monoidal category case, it's very much almost like a question of doing coherence backwards. So usually you start with some algebraic thing and you say, okay, what does the free thing look like in some sort of geometric way? But what we're doing is starting with a picture and saying, what algebraic thing gives this as the free thing for it? Right. So let's start with n equals 0. So these are just sets of things, right? Because we're zero categories with some extra structure. And for k equals 0, all we are is oriented zero manifolds in zero space. That's not very interesting. Oriented zero manifolds in zero space. So there's only two things you can have, right? You can have a point and you can have it's the same thing oppositely oriented. So this is the totality of these things is just a set with two things in it. So there's an involution. It's not a very interesting one, but it says the dual of this is this and the dual of this is this. So you've got this involution going on. So we think that the algebraic version is, well, it's, for a start, it's got to be some sort of zero monoidal zero category. That's just a set. And a dual is given by an involution on it. So it's a set, say, A, and we've got an involution from A to A, and if you do it twice, you get back to exactly the same thing you started with. So the free one of those is something like this. Not very much going on there. So what about k equals 1? A little bit more happens. This is oriented zero manifolds in one space. And remember, it's isotopy classes of them. So we're not particularly interested exactly where they are in our interval, but we're just going to kind of count them and count their orientation. So, for example, here's a perfectly good one. So, you know, if this x was a little bit further along here, we don't want to count it as being different. So what does this look like? Well, this looks like this looks like some sort of free monoid, right, with an involution. And it's not a commutative monoid because we can't make an isotopy to get this one past this one. So it's basically strings of positively and negatively. We could call these positive and these ones negative, this one negative, for example. So it's strings of positively and negatively oriented points. What would the dual be? So according to what we did before, for a dual, what we're supposed to do is reflect the whole thing in the last direction and then reverse all the orientations. So the dual of that should be that you reflect the whole thing and reverse the orientation. So this is now an x star, this is x star, and this is x star. So what this is saying is that the dual of x, y should be y star, x star. So this is, as Bruce was saying, it's some sort of interaction between the duals and the composition. So what we're looking at is a one monoidal zero category, which is, of course, some kind of monoid. Well, it's a monoid. And a dual is given by an involution, again, satisfying this relation, such that that's true. Are there any questions about that? Okay, so let's go on to k equals 2. So now we're looking at oriented zero manifolds in 2 space. And now that we're in two space, we have plenty of room to move these zero manifolds around each other. And so when we take our isotropy classes of them, we don't in any way care where they were. We just care how many of each one there was, how many there was. And so what we've got here, that's a bit ambiguous. These look like they're duals, but they're actually supposed to be points. Oh well. So what we've now got here is a commutative monoid, which is what we're expecting, right? Because we've got to the stable part of our periodic table, where we went set, monoid, commutative monoid. And now we can see why the stabilization is very compelling. Because if we go up to three dimensions, we just get the same thing. From this point on, with any more dimensions we have, we just get the same thing, because we always have enough space to move all these points around each other. So it's always going to be a commutative monoid. So now we have a commutative monoid. Duals, as before, satisfying the same thing, although we didn't have to be so careful about reversing these things because we're a commutative monoid now. And then the free one of those on one object is going to correspond to isotropy classes of these zero manifolds in K space for all K greater than or equal to 2. So all K greater than or equal to 2 gives the same thing, which we can compare with stabilization. Okay, are there any questions about that? Right, in that case, that's... Sorry? Yeah, it's for all n. So now we can do n equals 1, which is the second column on the handout. And because n equals 1, we're looking at categories with some extra structure, so something a bit more... thing is going on. So we have to say what the object and the morphisms are. And for k equals 0, we've got no codimension again. So the objects are oriented zero manifolds in zero space, and there are still not very many of them. And the morphisms are one manifold in one space, and there aren't very many of those either. And so the only thing we can have is we've got two possible objects, X and X star, and each one has these are not morphisms. I'm not drawing the directions because of the morphisms. I'm drawing the orientation of the one manifold. So all there is two objects and identity morphisms on them. So it's just discrete on this two-element set. So algebraically, we have a zero monoidal one category, which is just a category, and the duals, well, on objects it's an involution again. And on morphisms, well, this picture hasn't really told us anything, but given that we knew what the thing was on monoids, we suspect that it ought to be for all F from A to B, a G from, I suppose I should call it F star, such that F star star equals F, and that F G star equals G star F star. This does imply that the dual of the identity is the identity. So the free thing on one object just gives us exactly what we were looking for. 1 star equals 1. So 3 on one object is that. So now let's do k equals 1. The objects are now 0 manifolds in 1 cubes. So the objects are things like this, with some orientations on them, perhaps. I'm going to stop writing x's and I'm just going to put plus and minus for their orientations. And the morphisms are 1 manifold in 2 cubes. So the source is the 0 manifolds that we have at the top, which might be this. And the target could be some other thing. Let me try and draw something that actually works. That's never going to work. Oh, well, let's see. We can do this, and we can do this. And now we can... I want to have something going like this at the bottom. All right, so we can have this, and we can pretend that that one never existed. Right. So, we've got various relationships. We know, again, that the double dual is going to be the dual, and we know that tensoring is going to be putting things side by side. So x tensor y dual, it's going to be like how we did it before. We want to reflect. Wait a minute. No, it's not the category of tangles because we're only in two space. So we want to get a reversing for the duals on the zero cells. But what about on the one cells? For the one cells, when we take the dual, remember, we want to reflect it in its last direction. So we're going to reflect it like this. Okay. So if we take the dual, this could be decomposed as this morphism tensored with this morphism. And when we reflect it, the order of that tensor isn't going to change. But all we're going to do is we're going to take the dual of this individually and take the dual of that individually and tensor them in the same places. So we have to be a bit careful about whether we're tensoring one cell, dualing one cell or zero cells. So Byers and Dolan like to write the dual on one cell with a different thing to show that this is different. But Bruce is shaking his head vehemently, and I prefer to do this as well and just keep a clear head. But anyway. So on one cell, we don't reverse the order of the tensoring. Sorry? But at the top, it's got to be the opposite from the bottom. So if at the top we're going from plus to minus, then at the bottom we're going from minus to plus. So now, since I don't seem to be writing anything on the algebra side, because I put all my algebraic equations on the left, I'm going to fill up this space with some more observations that Byers and Dolan make. What are the unit and co-unit for the duals on objects? So if we've got x and x star, right, so this is x tensor x star. So we want something that goes from that to 1 for the co-unit on x. So this is this thing. And the unit is something that goes from nothing to those things tensored the other way around. So that's x star to x. And because this is at the bottom, the orientation goes from x star to x. But then we can observe what happens if we take duals of these things, something interesting happens. So if we take the dual of eta x, we reflect this whole thing and then change the orientations. We change the orientation of the one cell, of the one manifold. So we don't change the orientation of these zero things, and we have to change the orientation of that. So that's the dual of epsilon. So what about eta of x star? So for eta of x star, because x double star is the same as x, down here we want x and x star, because this is in fact x star star. So we want something that goes like this, and we're at the bottom, so we're going from star to non-star. So look, this turns out to look rather a lot like that. And this is an equation that Byers and Dolan declare is going to exist, that epsilon x dual is the same as eta of x dual. And this is essentially a relationship between duals on one cell and unit and co-unit for the zero cells. Okay, I've run out of algebraic. Oh, I just wrote on that board. I'm going to write on this board. So we're looking for, at this point, a one monoidal one category. Well, that's just a monoidal category. Which is just a... monoidal category. And for the duals on zero cells, these are going to be duals in the ordinary sense of duals in a monoidal category, that is, equipped with unit and co-unit satisfying triangle identities. And for the one cells, we're going to have the same condition that we had before with just the composition holding, and then we're going to have this extra equation governing the the unit and the co-unit of one dimension and the thing above. So basically, we think to ourselves, well, in order for the free thing to look like that, we've got to at least satisfy all the equations that those things satisfied with duals satisfying those equations. Okay, are there any questions about that? Yeah, because they're equations between two cells, right? One cells. It's not very visible, but that thing about the duals is all about one cells, and we're only in a monoidal category, so there's nothing else we can say about one cells except that they're equalities. So that is a question. That's another thing that some category theorists don't really like, that perhaps that ought to be a weak thing. But because John is really thinking about this actual example, it's actually true in this example that it's an involution in the strict sense. So I believe there's some quote of Max Kelly which I can't utter exactly in public, but something to do with the fact that if you've got some strictness there, you might as well use it, because there's so much weakness going on in the world that is difficult to handle. Right. I can feel my partitioning of the boards becoming a bit futile. Never mind. Let's go on to the really exciting case, the last case I want to talk about today, which is a case that was studied completely separately from these questions by Mei-Chi Shum quite a long time ago. So for k equals 2, the object are zero manifolds in two space, such as this, and the one the one cells, that is the morphisms, are going to be one manifold in three space. So we have some possibility of tangly, Brady-like things going on. So now I'm going to make this source thing flat at the top. Here are some objects in it, and here is my target two space with some things in it, and we're going to be in some sort of three cube, which is very wobbly, and now I'm going to draw some sort of tangle, which looks a bit like, I don't know, all sorts of things can happen. Well, anyway, something. So, what's this? Well, now the framing on this manifold, I haven't really talked about the framing because we didn't get far enough into dimensions to have anything interesting going on, but now the framing gives us more than just an orientation on this thing. And this is where this business of having ribbons and twisting things up goes. Because, for example, if you have something like this, it's not very simply the same as that, because when you untwist it, now I get to use my little prop. So you start with, wait, let's try and do this right. You start with it like that, with the whole black side supposed to be still facing you. And if you try and straighten it out, look, you end up with some twist in it. So this, it's not simply tangles in the sense that you can just straighten anything out that you think you can straighten out in three dimensions. The framing means that we have to keep track of some sort of twisty things going on. And so this is where we're going to start looking at this coherence question backwards a bit. So on the algebraic side, we want some sort of two monoidal one category, which is some kind of braided monoidal category. And what's the extra structure that we want? Well, we know from Joyal and Street's paper that coherence for just braided monoidal categories without anything else is solved by taking the braid category. So for just braided monoidal categories, the free thing, free on one object, is the braid category, which has morphisms that look like braids. But we don't get to have any tangles because we don't have anything like this. so we don't get to be very tangled up. But that does deal with the kind of under and over crossing issue. Another thing we know is that we know about symmetric monoidal categories with duals. Which are otherwise known as compact closed categories. And coherence for this was solved by Kelly and LaPlaza. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true. But we're going to see how these things mysteriously coincide in the end. So with duals or objects. Thank you. So this gives us diagrams that look a bit like tangles without having any under and over crossings. So we can do all this kind of stuff, but because we're symmetric and not braided, now that looks like some Greek letters. Okay, that looks a bit less like some Greek letters. So it looks a bit like a tangle, except that we don't have any under and over crossings. So this is in fact going to be useful for when we're doing one manifold in four space, because in four space we don't have any undercrossings and overcrossings anymore, and we've gone into the symmetric situation, which is the stable situation, and then in any dimension above four, the same is going to be true, that you can unknot anything and pass braids through each other, as it were. So, but this, it does give us these loopy-like things. So Shum considered braided monoidal categories with duals for the objects. Now I'm really going to give up on splitting this board. So Shum wanted to generalize those two results to get braided monoidal categories with duals for objects, but she needed to consider this business of twisting, because in a braided monoidal category with duals for objects, it isn't in general true. We can't actually say that in general, but the example she gives is this. So you can do that in a braided monoidal category with duals, because this is the dual here, and then you take the braid like that. That is not, in general, equal to that. And so what she adds is a piece of structure called a twist, and calls it a tautile tensor category. And the twist is the thing that records the number of times you've done things like that and ended up with a twist. And that's what's going to correspond to a framing on the tangle that results. That's actually what I meant, yes. Thank you. It's certainly not equal to the... So this is tautile tensor categories. Or tautile monoidal categories. In her thesis, it's called tensor categories. So the idea is that if you thicken this strand, so it's actually thick like a ribbon, then when you straighten it out, you can record what happened by putting a twist in or something. I'm not sure if I've got my twist going the right way, but it's something like that. So, for every... What this is, it's a braided monoidal category, a tautile tensor category is a braided monoidal category . So what this structure is supposed to answer is the following question: what algebraic structure is it whose free thing on one object gives us framed oriented one tangles in three space? And here's an algebraic answer to that. Bruce, you look unhappy. So we'll see what happens there. So, but this is still trying to just answer the question: what is it that gives us framed oriented one tangles in three space? So it's a braided monoidal category equipped with, for every object, a right dual with unit and co-unit. For every object, a twist. An extra piece of structure. So for every object A twist called theta A, which is just an isomorphism from A to A, satisfying, so this is an isomorphism such that the twist on the identity is just the identity. So the twist on the unit object for the monoidal structure is just that. Now if we think about the free thing, the unit object for the monoidal structure is empty, so the twist for it better not be anything. And then there's a quite interesting coherence axiom, which says if you take A tensor B and you do the braiding, so this is about the interaction between the twist and the braiding. If you do the braiding, you get B tensor A. You can now do the twist on B and the twist on A separately, and you can do the braiding back again. And that should be the same as just doing the braiding all at the twist all at once. So I will now attempt to draw this as a picture. What's this going to correspond to in terms of tangles? It's quite fun. So down the left-hand side, you're taking A, which is a thickened tangle, right? And B, which is another thickened tangle. And we're going to twist them all up all at once. So we're doing an entire twist all the way around. So on the other side, what do we do when we come down here? We take our A and our B, and now we're braiding them. So braiding just means take B across over the top, straight across like this. Now we do each twist separately. So we do a twist on this B strand here, which says twist it all the way around. And then we do a twist on this A strand. And now we braid them back across each other. And if you stare at that for a while, you can see that those are the same thing. It's sort of like taking two telephone cords and twisting them and sort of looping them inside each other. So in the end, what she does is that she gives up on drawing double tangles because it gets a bit involved. And instead, she just counts the number of twists there is on each tangle. So this is really like your framing, counting the number of times your framing has gone round. So instead of thickening everything, you just have an ordinary tangle with an integer attached to it, saying how many times round you twisted. So it could be positively twisted or negatively twisted. And then when you compose them, you add up your twists, which makes sense, right? But that's a technicality at this point. There's another axiom which says that the twist on the dual of A has to be the same as... Now, before Bruce starts getting really upset about why I've written a dual for one cell, there is something a bit like a dual that you can do. This is a different kind of dual. Here, star is different. And it's given like this. Given any morphism f from A to B, you can get a morphism f star from B star to A star. Like this. Essentially, you're going to just turn f upside down by sticking units and co-units at either end of it. So let's do it down here because we've got more space. So here's F from A to B. And what you can do is you can stick an eta A at the top like that and an epsilon B. Have I got this the wrong way around? No, that's right. An epsilon B at the bottom like this. And then when you compose that with the identity on B star and the identity on A star, you can see that that makes a morphism from B star to A star that has essentially his F turned F upside down. Yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that is something that you can do. That is something you can do. So what's this axiom saying? It's saying that if you turn a twist upside down, you get the same thing. That's what it's saying. Right. So the coherence theorem that she proved is the following one. That the free torsile tensor category on one object is equivalent in a suitable sense to the tangle category of framed oriented tangles, one tangled in three space. So, something funny has happened, as Bruce keeps pointing out to me, that there's something different is going on here. We started off by thinking about duals on objects and morphisms, and we ended up by thinking about duals on objects together with this twist thing, and somehow we got the same thing. Now, one thing that it's important to remember is that this is only an equivalence of categories. So one of the things that has happened is that this equivalence uses the fact that although A double dual isn't the same as A, it's isomorphic to A. And so that's going to come into it. So it's not an actual, you have to be careful if you're going to think that the free thing is these tangles. Because of course in this tangle category, the double dual really is equal to the same thing. And that's not in general true in one of those things. So it's not actually the free thing on one object, because it's got an extra equation being true that isn't in general true. So it can't be the same, but it can be equivalent to it. Now what has happened with this twist business is that if you're in the situation that we started with, then this thing here is going to give you a twist that's a perfectly good twist. And what? Okay. So what's happened here? What is this thing? What is that thing? So what we've got is a braid over here, and we've got a thing that way up and a thing this way up down here, right? And if you write down all the objects that these are, so for example, if that was an X and this is an X, okay, so this is an X here, so this is an X star, this is an X star, and this is an X, right? This isn't a unit and co-unit for something. It's a dual for something else. And so if you've got duals for one cell, you can express this thing, because you can take, this is probably a unit for X, and then you can attach the dual as a one cell dual. So now I should probably write it something different so that we remember that it's not that kind of dual, but it's this kind of dual. You can stick that on the end. And it happens that in the thing that we started off by talking about, we declared that eta x dual was going to be the same as epsilon x dual. Possibly I wrote it the other way around, but they're equivalent. And we could only even say this because the unit and because the double dual was exactly the same as the original object. so we can only so what we're starting with in the case that we started trying to express was something that was inherently stricter. And so it's still possible. So you might think, well, how is it possible that we could get the same structure out as a free structure? But because we've only got an equivalence here, it is possible. So this is a coherence result, right? So some amount of strictification can have happened in this coherence result. And that's essentially what has happened. It's a sort of curious fact that when you do this equivalence result, you just do get duals for one cells, because in this tangle category there simply are duals for one cells, even though they weren't forced to exist by the free structure, they pop out anyway. So this is worth noting. NB. The tangle category, as I defined it over there, which, as in up there, simply does have duals for one cell, even though they weren't forced to exist by the free structure. They weren't explicitly forced. Explicitly. So something has happened which we don't understand at the moment, which is that we seem to have two different, quite different looking algebraic ways of generating equivalent free structures, one of which involves this funny notion of dual at the top dimension that has no unit and co-unit. The other of which, instead, doesn't have that funny notion, has an extra piece of structure called a balancing instead, a twist, or why don't call it a balancing. They have this twist instead, and somehow those produce equivalent structures. This is, I think, rather interesting, and it's not something we understand, but perhaps points to something we should look for when we're defining our general notion, and that perhaps in general, instead of having the funny notion of dual at the top with no unit and co-unit, we could have some extra piece of structure a bit lower down that forced those things to exist. Well, that's about all I want to say today. Tomorrow, I want to talk about the next slight dimension up, which is what Byers and Langford did in HDA4, two tangles in four space, and some general higher dimensional attempts to make this work. Are there any questions about this? Good, or something. Let's have some coffee. Hi.
If you forget about the framing, then just the tangles without the framing as a category is equivalent to three braided monoidal categories or something like that. Without that extra data. I thought this was true, but I thought you made a statement to the contrary.
I think it's not true because of that thing that I drew on the board. I think this doesn't have to be true.
I just have a braided monoidal category of duals.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be true.
Yeah. And therefore that can't hold in the free thing either.
Okay. Sure.